Okay, it looks like we can get started. So first of all, thank you everybody for joining. It is good to see some familiar faces, get the gang back together again here. And so I would call to order this interim hearing of the Health, Finance, and Policy Committee. Thank you everybody for attending today, taking time out of your interim, because we all know the legislature is not in session now. And so members are off doing the many things they do during the interim. So I appreciate everybody joining us today. This should be a very interesting hearing. I'm really looking forward to it. And so we're going to hear a couple of presentations today. We're first of all going to hear a presentation on some research from the Mayo Clinic on the long-term health impacts of COVID-19. And then we're going to hear from the Department of Health, kind of an update on what's going on with the pandemic and talking about the vaccines that are now available for children ages 5 to 11. So we've got a lot of information to cover. So we're going to start with the first presentation. I think it would be most helpful if members would hold questions to the end of the presentation. I think it'll be relatively brief, and then we'll have some time for sharing, for asking questions. And members, please raise your hand in the usual way if you would like to ask a question. And Ms. Niedernhofer will keep a list. So first of all, I am very excited to have with us today Dr. Rosalina McCoy, who is at the Mayo Clinic. She's an endocrinologist and primary care physician, and she is a National Institutes of Health funded health services researcher. So her interests are in care, main interests, I know she has a lot of them, but they're in the care of people with diabetes and ways to deliver and evaluate other chronic disease care. And then we will also be hearing from David Jiang, who is a healthcare policy researcher at the Robert D. and Patricia E. Kern Center for the Science of Healthcare Delivery at Mayo Clinic. And he is, among other things, studying the health policy implications of the COVID-19 pandemic. So I will first welcome Dr. McCoy. Thank you so much for joining us today. And I will turn it over to her to talk about what they're going to talk about.
Thank you so much, Madam Chairman, and thank you for having us share our recent research about the long-term health effects of COVID-19. Like you mentioned, David and I led this work, and actually we're going to let David start it off.
Okay, welcome.
Yeah, thank you, Rosalina. Thank you, Chair Liebling. Good afternoon, representatives. We are honored to present this research. Our research on long COVID and its impacts to health and society. And so before we get started, we just want to thank our co-authors, Brett Gu, Jake Roy, and Leslie Hassett for their contributions. And the contents of this presentation do not reflect the official policy of Mayo Clinic, but they reflect the findings and views from our own research. And so please allow us to give a brief context of our research into long COVID. So when the pandemic started in January of 2020, much of the work surrounding COVID research was focused on the initial response, the allocation of resources, stay-at-home orders, how to make sure we have enough ventilators in ICU rooms, et cetera. So however, from two previous coronavirus pandemics, SARS in 2002 and MERS in 2012, we know that the coronavirus and coronaviruses have long-term health effects that last for weeks or months. And so in July of 2020, Dr. McCoy and I authored a prospective commentary on the need to research long COVID symptoms and plan for possible mitigation strategies. Since then, long COVID has been given an official name by the CDC. It is called post-acute sequelae of severe acute respiratory syndrome coronavirus 2 infection, or PASC. In this presentation, we will use the terms long COVID and PASC interchangeably. And so in July of this year, we published one of the first comprehensive systematic reviews of the known symptoms of long COVID and described populations who are most susceptible to developing long COVID. We also detailed some possible recommendations to mitigate its effects. To write this paper, we read over 3,000 peer-reviewed articles published between January 2020 to May 31st, 2021. So that brings us to the presentation today, and we have five key takeaways from our research. First, long COVID is very common. It is multisystemic, which means that it affects nearly every organ and body system. PASC appears to disproportionately impact certain populations, such as minorities, older populations, patients with pre-existing conditions, and rural residents. These impacts will not only be felt in a medical context, but also across all segments of society, and therefore we will need a concerted effort to better understand and mitigate the effects of long COVID. So to our first point, long COVID is very common. We defined PASC during our study as any new or continued COVID-19 symptoms persisting longer than 4 weeks after initial infection. Some of these symptoms we found were experienced by patients more than 6 months after the initial infection. After our study was published, so in October of this year, the WHO published its own definition, which is a lot more specific than ours. Our review found that between 33 to 98% of patients who have recovered from the initial COVID-19 infection will experience some persisting symptom or new symptom lasting longer than 4 weeks. If we contextualize this a little bit, given that as of today, 46 million Americans and close to 800,000 Minnesotans have had COVID-19, and most of these patients will recover from the initial illness, that means that a conservative estimate of at least 15 million Americans or 250,000 Minnesotans will experience some form of long COVID symptoms. And so Dr. McCoy will now go into what these symptoms are.
Thank you, David. So if you can go to the next slide, I think one of the things that really struck us by reviewing the literature to date about the long-term manifestation of COVID is the fact that it really does affect every organ system in our bodies and almost every person that survives COVID-19. Now, most of the data that we analyze and that is available to date is for adults only, and there are emerging studies for kids, which I'll touch upon shortly. But you can see here the different manifestations and different systems that are affected by long COVID, as well as the estimates of the proportion of people that are affected. Now, you'll see that some of these rates vary, and that's because we really reviewed a wide range of studies, everything that has been published on this topic. So the rate really depends on the specific population that was being studied, how ill the individuals were with COVID-19, as studies varied between people who had any infection versus people who had to be hospitalized, as well as were done in different countries and in different times of the pandemic, they were affected by different variants. That said, I think even looking conservatively, these symptoms are very common. The most common is dyspnea, or shortness of breath, which affects in all studies up to 90% of people, so 9 out of 10 survivors. Other common symptoms are cough, affecting headaches, cognitive impairment. So things that really affect people's quality of life. And you can see here, I'll just briefly run through them. So the common neurological deficits are, we often think about taste and smell. Those effects can linger in about half of the individuals who survive COVID. But things like headache, brain fog or cognitive impairment, hearing loss, as well as potential for vision loss. Now, I want to call attention to cognitive impairment specifically because mechanistically, the same pathway that causes olfactory and gustatory dysfunction or taste and smell is thought to be similar to what happens early on with Alzheimer's dementia and with Parkinson's disease. So time and additional research is going to be needed to see whether COVID-19 is going to be a long-term risk factor for developing Alzheimer's dementia or Parkinson's disease or other related dementias. But I think the possibility of that, considering the number of people who are affected, is certainly very striking. It affects the cardiovascular system with shortness of breath, palpitations, We hear a lot about myocarditis, and COVID-19, just like other viral illnesses, do cause myocarditis in up to 4% of individuals. There's concern for stroke and POTS. There's GI side effects with loss of appetite, acid reflux, diarrhea, vomiting, other abdominal symptoms. With mental health impacts, both due to COVID-19, the experience of being treated for a potentially severe illness with post-traumatic stress disorder, depression and anxiety, and really almost a half of people who survive it experience some sort of long-term psychiatric and mental health manifestations. Already spoke about pulmonary disease, but beyond the symptoms of dyspnea, data of persistent lung damage that is experienced. And I think that's really serious for potentially for kids who may have long-term persistent lung damage. And we see impaired pulmonary function, a pulmonary function test, and anywhere on about a quarter to about a half of people, depending again on when the studies were done. Finally, other complications that have been described in different case reports, but not necessarily quantified on a population level, beyond chronic fatigue. So that's kind of the most common feeling, people just feeling exhausted. That affects almost every survivor for quite some time as they recover from the illness. But other injuries include kidney damage, new onset diabetes, because COVID-19 causes pancreatic injuries. So the pancreas just cannot make insulin. So it's not the fact, it's not because people are isolated, are at home, and their blood sugars worsen. It's really the virus itself causing diabetes. Pediatric inflammatory multisystemic syndrome that I'll talk about shortly. And then skin rash, hair loss, erectile dysfunction, and really other symptoms that affect survivors. And, you know, chronic fatigue is one of those symptoms that affects everybody. And there's a wide range in how debilitated people can be. You know, so I have patients who are young, healthy, you know, in their 20s, and after surviving COVID-19 are so debilitated by their fatigue that they're not able to work anymore. So it really does, there is a wide range and can be quite debilitating. You can go on to the next slide. So, for pediatric cases, because kids, we all know the kids are not little adults, the data are still emerging. And there's a lot of great research that's done out of University of Minnesota for pediatric COVID and long COVID symptoms. But a lot of the symptoms that have been described are similar to those of adults. Kids experience insomnia, fatigue, muscle pain, headaches, lack of concentration, potentially symptoms that may overlap or exacerbate or even cause ADHD. In one study, 68% of symptoms, 68% of children had symptoms that lasted beyond the 3 months. Now, we hear a lot about PIMS, which is rare but very serious complication of COVID in children. It presents with toxic shock syndrome and myocarditis, so it's kids can get very ill. Usually, children present days to weeks after recovery from the acute infection with fatigue, fever, abdominal pain, and other GI symptoms, dyspnea, or shortness of breath, and headaches. It's been reported, again, variably depending on the population, about 2%, two out of 100 kids who have COVID-19. So there's been a 30-fold increase in this disease during the pandemic, and 3.5% of kids who have PIMS die from this illness. And that is more prevalent in children of Afro-Caribbean descent. Next slide. Now, the symptoms and task itself appears to disproportionately affect specific populations. So if we can go on to the next slide, I think a lot of this is driven by the fact that certain populations are at highest risk for both developing COVID-19 and then for developing severe COVID-19. And again, because the only people who can get long COVID are people who had COVID to begin with, that creates really a disproportionate impact of long COVID on racial and ethnic minorities, older people, patients with pre-existing health conditions, as well as people in rural areas for a variety of reasons. But now there's data that is emerging that suggests that these populations may be at higher risk for developing long COVID beyond the fact that they are more likely to get COVID to begin with. And I think research on that is emerging, just like a lot of the research about COVID-19. So if we can go on to the next slide, I pass it back to David to talk about the impacts of PASC on all segments of society.
So the fourth point we wanted to emphasize is that the effects of long COVID is not just medical, but because of how pervasive COVID, long COVID could be, and we saw that in one instance, 98% of patients could experience chronic fatigue for months after infection, long COVID and its impact will be felt across all segments of society. And in school settings, and we have already heard anecdotes of children who had COVID-19 returning to schools and behaving differently or have trouble focusing or concentrating on schoolwork. So teachers and educators must be properly prepared to identify these students and support them. This probably means extra training or resources for educators. In correctional facilities, which were disproportionately impacted by COVID outbreaks due to their confined spaces, they must now care for an aging and sicker population due to long COVID. Employers could expect decrease in productivity and the greater need for accommodations for their workers. Just as an example, before COVID, researchers and economists estimated that chronic fatigue syndrome, which again will affect up to 98% of COVID survivors, chronic fatigue syndrome reduced household productivity by 37% and labor force productivity by 54%. In terms of economic terms, the total annual value of lost productivity across the United States was $9.1 billion, which comes down to about $20,000 lost per person. These calculations were done in 2004 before the pandemic, and now we expect there to be a lot more patients with chronic fatigue syndrome, and accordingly, we infer a larger value in lost productivity. Payers such as Medicare and Medicaid and insurance companies should prepare for higher cost of care for a sicker population. And lastly, healthcare systems will be facing a larger and more complex patient population and will require resources and infrastructure to care for patients with complex needs. And so finally, a concerted effort by healthcare professionals, by payers, by public health officials, and state and local governments are urgently needed to better understand and mitigate long COVID. So public health officials, and I think you'll hear from our colleagues at MDH later, they will have to provide surveillance for PASC incidence, prevalence, severity, and susceptibility. Not only will they need to track the health-related symptoms, but they should also track the economic and social impact, such as disability and absenteeism from school or work. Those in healthcare settings need to set up multidisciplinary long COVID clinics. I know that University of Minnesota and Mayo both have these clinics set up and are conducting deeper research into long COVID. We need to provide support to our primary care providers who will be caring for the majority of these patients and be burdened by the brunt of this public health crisis. They need the proper infrastructure, guidelines, and resources to care for patients. And in our paper, we recommended that patients who recover from COVID-19 be screened for PASC symptoms 1 to 2 months after recovery. And communities will need to provide resources to educators and other members of the community to recognize PASC and manage its effects. Socioeconomically disadvantaged tribal and rural populations have fewer access to health resources, and they will need those resources to alleviate health disparities. We recommend that payers, again, such as Medicaid, cover costs associated with PASC screenings and management to provide more access to those in need, and insurance schemes need to plan for increased expenditure around PASC.
Right, and then finally, I think some mitigation strategies that we suggest based on our research on the topic. I think the first is really making sure sure that people do not get COVID-19, because the most effective and really guaranteed way not to get passed is not to get COVID. So promoting and supporting, facilitating vaccination and other infection control measures is really critical. The other, I think, important note about vaccination is that in people who already have passed, there is data that the currently available vaccines may relieve past symptoms. So we should encourage individuals who have not yet been vaccinated and have passed to be vaccinated. Again, not only to prevent them from getting recurrent COVID-19, which does happen, but also to relieve their symptom burden and disability. And then finally, we need to ensure timely and affordable access to medical care for patients who have PASC. They need to have access to primary care. It needs to be accessible, available, and affordable and used. And then finally, improve access to essential services beyond primary care, things like physical therapy, mental health counseling, and care management that currently aren't a part of routine health offerings, especially for younger individuals who are not of Medicare age. I think that's very important because we consider a whole population of people developing multimorbidity and disability as a result of COVID-19. So, we can go on to our next slide.
Yeah, so representatives, in summary, long COVID is experienced by up to 98% of those who recover from the initial infection. And it affects nearly every organ system, from pulmonary, cardiovascular, neurologic, psychiatric systems. These complications could last more than 6 months. Pediatric patients are not immune to PASC, and older patients, racial and ethnic minorities, patients with pre-existing conditions, and rural residents appear to be disproportionately impacted. PASC is not just a medical issue, but it will be impacted, by its impact, will be felt in educational, community, and workplace settings. And lastly, we provided recommendations and mitigation strategies and call for a concerted efforts by key stakeholders and decision makers to study and alleviate the impacts of long COVID. And with that, we'll be happy to take your questions. If you have any detailed questions or would like to know more, please feel free to contact us.
Well, thank you so much. It is really sobering to see that data. And of course, this is all still very new. And I know that from what you've reviewed, and you did send out copies of the research paper to the committee. But of course, looking at the literature over a period of time, and the pandemic's been changing during that time as well. So as we learn more, I'm sure I'm sure there's a lot of knowledge to come, I guess is what I'm trying to say, because the pandemic is changing and the data is continuing to come in. And wow, this is really important work. And thank you very much. I saw that Representative Quam wanted to ask a question. Go ahead, Representative Quam. And if you could take the slides down, please. I don't, unless someone needs to, wants to refer to one of them. Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And, you know, looking at, I'm a numbers guy, and I'm seeing where you've got 33 to 98%. That seems, you know, a 3X variation. Is that because of the unconfirmed or the asymptomatic cases could be affecting the total pool?
Dr. McCoy or David, David, do you want to answer that? I see you're unmuted, so go ahead.
Sure. Representative Quam, thank you so much for the question. The variation in rates is not due to sort of the unconfirmed nature, perhaps, but it is because of the different study populations that these studies accommodate for. So it's not a standardized study. Between the over 3,000 papers that we looked at, some studies look at long COVID in a hospitalized patient, so patients who've been hospitalized, to patients who are surveyed in sort of the general population who've had COVID. So that range, right? So the 33%, I believe, was from out of those who experience hospitalization, which is severe long COVID symptoms, to 98%, which is the number for chronic fatigue syndrome. Dr. McCoy, do you have anything to add?
Dr. McCoy?
Absolutely. That's exactly right. So I think the variability is due to the different ways in which these data were ascertained. I mean, some had people come into the clinic to provide their symptom burden. Others were done by survey. There was a variability in the patient populations that were studied. So I think that's why it's so critical to have really robust population level surveillance data for us to know exactly what we're dealing with, how long, how severe the symptoms are, how long do they last. It's really hard, I think, to fight an enemy that you don't know well. So having that data on a population level is going to be critical. I think what our data has revealed is just how that it is a problem. It's a serious and common problem. But I don't think that there, at least, you know, since we were reviewing other published studies, we can't say with certainty exactly how common they are and how severe they are, but rather we can describe what other people have seen. And it's going to be important for us here in Minnesota to do that surveillance work to establish, you know, who's affected, how often, for how long, and how badly.
Madam Chair.
Thank you. Representative Quam, follow-up?
Yes, it'd be nice to have the pool, you know, sort of the information of the different pools that were taken, because it was surprising to me that a vast majority of the people that were asymptomatic would then have this serious condition. And so it'd be very useful to understand, especially if it's just a small portion of COVID patients that are hospitalized, if that's where it's a third to, you know, those percentages. That kind of detail helps us to better understand, as opposed to just, you know, a PowerPoint entry, because I know at least 100 people that have had COVID, some of them breakthrough cases, and I'm not seeing 3 in 10 with it. So that's why understanding the populations of these studies would be useful. You know, offline, you can give us some more detail. And then it seems a little bit surprising that we would have 250,000 to 750,000 Minnesotans. And that's just the confirmed cases, not the asymptomatic, with this condition, and not have it more evident in the general communities. So the clarification of exactly this percentage relates to what populations and portions, and any information on the asymptomatic population, what percentage they have, would be quite useful. And then when you in the presentation touched on pediatric cases and the upswing, I noticed that the increase corresponded to the worldwide RSV spike that we saw. And it'd be nice if you could provide us the proportionality of hospitalization and ICU for peds with the RSV, and better understand the different comorbidities between adult and pediatric cases, because several physicians at Mayo have indicated there is a delta, you know, in comorbidities for the pediatric cases. So those would be useful, I think, for the committee to better understand the situation so that we could more effectively address. Thank you.
So Representative Quam, I mean, these folks are here to report on the research that they did today. I think some of these questions might perhaps be more appropriately directed to the Department of Health, but, you know, let me just
Madam
say,
Chair,
the beginning part of it, we did distribute to the committee the actual published paper, and I did read it, and I'm sure that it's the sources are cited there, and all of, Dr. McCoy is shaking her head, so it's all available, but just to make, kind of put a point on it, what they explained, this is research that does a survey of research that's out there. So you heard one of the two presenters say that they read, I think it was 3,000 papers or something. This is a huge number of published papers, and trying to pull together what information can be gleaned from all of that. So it's not like a study where you have a certain defined population, and that's where you get these estimates of what the percentages are. But, you know, I'm sure that either of them would be happy to talk with you further offline if you need more explanation on that.
Chair Liebling, may I be heard?
Mr. Jiang. And then I've got a couple more questions here. So go ahead.
Representative Kwom, you make a lot of good points. And I was just going to add that the data in terms of the proportion and rates and who the base populations are clearly laid out in our paper. So feel free, please, to reference. And if you have specific questions about any of the studies, we'd be happy to provide more details. Second point that I wanted to make is that asymptomatic patients are harder to report because they are, well, asymptomatic. So these studies that we looked at, a lot of them do only cover people who are reported symptomatic, those who have been tested positive for COVID-19. And so I don't think we could say that from people who are, quote, asymptomatic, we expect to see like 98% of people with chronic fatigue syndrome. But out of those who were symptomatic, out of those who were tested positive for COVID-19, we see a lot of that in this particular case. So, and then I'm not sure if Dr. McCoy has any comments on the pediatric piece, but other than that, that's all I have to say. Thank you, Madam Chair.
All right. Well, we've got a couple of more questions here. And Representative Grunhagen, you put your hand down. Did you still want to ask your question? And then Representative Breyer?
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. I just, I sure appreciate the presentation by the medical doctors and their research or compilation of research. And we sure want people to get the medical care they need in this area or whatever area. And this more comes from a constituent of mine and also a registered nurse and a doctor in my district. I just had a constituent who needs surgery, and he was told he should have immediate surgery, but then he was told they're not going to do surgery till the end of January, beginning of February, because of staffing shortages. That's what the doctor told him. He called me up and I had to hold the phone about a foot away from my ear because he was quite upset. And then a doctor in another hospital and an RN said, between losing nurses who are going to be terminated with this COVID vaccine mandate, and they're already stressed to the max, and just nurses that have left the profession because of COVID, they're not going to be able to give the care that patients actually need. And the last thing I saw is that there's the possibility of laying off 8,000 workers down at the Rochester.
So Representative Grunhagen, I'm going to interrupt you there because I think you're off the topic of our hearing today. And these two folks are here to present their research, and this is not part of their research. So I'm going to move on to Representative Ryer if you don't have a question on the topic before the committee.
Okay.
Thank you. Representative Ryer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Dr. McCoy and Mr. Jiang. I appreciate hearing this. As a researcher myself, I have nothing but an admiration for the size of this meta-analysis. I will tell you my jaw dropped in appreciation. But what I wondered was, I was thinking about the World Health Organization's definition, and it does differ a bit. And of course, it's new, so you didn't have time to consider that. I'm just curious if you have a sense of the impact of that on the incidence of what you've seen, and also, more importantly, the real crux of what I'm asking is implications on that for your recommendations, because I did appreciate the broad view you took. And if we look at it from different lenses, are there ways that we would further refine and execute those recommendations? Thank you.
Dr. McCoy?
Thank you, Representative Liebling and Representative Ryer. I think, you know, when we started to do our study, we used the definition that was being used at the time, which is symptoms that begin a month after the initial diagnosis and persist thereafter, as opposed to the WHO definition just from this past month, which looks at symptoms that begin 3 months after the initial diagnosis and then begin thereafter. That's really the critical difference. Most of the studies, so there was a lot of variability in the studies that we looked at when they contacted patients in order to ask about their symptoms in terms of how long that time span was between their illness and the time that patients were contacted. The vast majority of the studies contacted patients anywhere between 1 month and 6 months since diagnosis. And the main reason for that is that we were looking at studies as they were being published. And with COVID-19 still being so new, there was just no time for longer follow-up. I think that what we know from the literature is that in many individuals, but not all, symptoms do gradually wane over time. So I think our study suggests how many people are likely to be affected for the first probably several months, potentially up to 6 months after that initial diagnosis. And time is going to be needed again with that surveillance work to figure out how long those symptoms last. We don't know if these symptoms are going to last, you know, 6 months, a year, 2 years, or they may be lifelong. I think if we look at what we know from other viral infections, where people may have debility for several months up to a year, while other people just the way that their immune systems react, and they may develop chronic fatigue, they may develop fibromyalgia, they may develop other autoimmune or rheumatologic conditions that have their origin in viral illnesses. So I think we'll have to, that time will tell, and that's why it's important. But in terms of the impact on kind of the policy recommendations and mitigation strategies, I think those still apply, because even if, you know, if kids are struggling in school after they come back, you know, from their infection, I think teachers will still need to recognize why their kids are struggling and help them through that time period. Employers will need to figure out how to help their staff stay in the workplace successfully and not leave workplace. I'm a primary care physician, and I think people, you know, my colleagues and I, we would need guidance and help on recognizing and appropriately treating these symptoms. The duration with which that happens, I'm hoping, isn't going to be very long for the vast majority of people, but we are going to need to continue investigating and studying that.
Representative Breyer? Okay, great. Thank you. And I have one quick one, and I know we want to bring the end of this segment, but this is, again, thank you so much. This was extremely eye-opening, really, to bring this information together, and very concerning for us as policymakers about what we may be looking at in the future. But I did want to ask Dr. McCoy, when you went through all the various kinds of impacts that this can have on different body systems, and, you know, what can you tell us about the possible mechanisms? I mean, I had read or heard that this was thought of as a vascular disease. You just said something about the immune system. I mean, I'm sure there are various kinds of mechanisms, but what are the primary things that seem to tie all these impacts together?
Representative Liebling, that's a good question. I know there's a lot of research just into the mechanisms of the disease, just like into the mechanisms of the manifestation of COVID-19, because the acute infection manifests itself far beyond just a respiratory illness as well. The pathophysiology itself is not my area of expertise, but I think from the clinical perspective, and what I tell my patients is that, you know, COVID-19 really appears to trigger a significant inflammatory response, and inflammation affects our whole body. It affects every organ system, from blood vessels to neurons, to our lungs, to our heart, you know, to our brains. And I think that inflammatory response is likely what is responsible for a lot of these manifestations. The shortness of breath that many people experience may be due to the pulmonary fibrosis and inflammation that is that develops as a result of that inflammatory response. The same thing for the neurological deficits, the neuropathy, all the cardiac manifestations. So I think that underlies a lot of the mechanisms, both of the acute infection and long COVID. And I think learning from other viruses, both coronaviruses and any viral infection, a lot of the long-term complications do seem to go through that immune or autoimmune pathway.
Great. Well,
one thing that if I may just
please,
you know, from just my own personal experience caring for people who have COVID-19 and survive COVID-19 mostly, you know, as a primary care doc, it is unfortunately and scarily very common for people to have debility. I think often, especially in young and high functioning individuals, it's something that they can brush aside. But I think that resiliency that many of us have, it may not be enough. And a lot of people, you know, it varies by individual, but I think a lot of people have been affected by this. And it's really, I am hopeful that it is not going to impact them forever and for a long time. But from the health system and just the public health perspective, the long-term impact of this viral illness are going to be felt for a long time, and they will affect a lot of people. And I think it's really important to plan, to understand it, plan for it, and have the mechanism in place to really grasp, to understand the burden and the populations at highest risk. So I'm really grateful and appreciative of the work that you're doing and that the state is focusing their attention on this, because from the patients that I care of, I think it's very important.
All right. Well, thank you again, and really appreciate your presentation today. And especially, I appreciate that you're doing this work. And, you know, this will be very helpful. I'm sure this is not going to be the last time we hear about this. And I know that this committee or its successors will be grappling with this for some time to come. So thank you very much. We appreciate that. So I'm going to turn now to the second presentation that we have, and that is with the Minnesota Department of Health. And we have, I think, Dr. Linfield here, who's our state epidemiologist and the medical director for the Department of Health. And there she is. Welcome, Dr. Linfield. I see you've got your slides up, and I'm going to turn it over to you.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair, and it's an honor to be here. So I'm going to give you an update today on a number of things happening with the pandemic, and I'm going to start with this epidemic curve. And there are a couple of things I'd like to point out here. If you take a look, the gray line is cases that are 12 to 18 years of age, and the orange line is 5 to 11. You can see how in the spring wave, when both 12 to 18 year olds and 5 to 11 year olds weren't eligible for vaccines, the case rate was much higher for 12 to 18 year olds. At peak, the 12 to 18 year olds had 1.7 times the case rate as 5 to 11 year olds. In the fall current wave, the cases in the 5 to 11 year olds are equal or higher than the 12 to 18 year olds. I also would like you to appreciate the impact of vaccination on the 19 to 64 year olds, which is the yellow line, and 65 and older, which is the lighter blue line. And these age groups were really driving cases even into the spring peak before vaccination was widely available. When you look at that case rate in 2020 going into early 2021. Let's go to the next slide. I would like you here to notice the disparities in hospitalization by social vulnerability index. This is a graph of hospitalizations over the past 7 months due to COVID, and you can see the blue line is the SVI quartile one, which is those that are most vulnerable. And unfortunately, we continue to see disparities. You may remember that Dr. McCoy and Mr. Zhang also noted harsher impact or potential harsher impact on vulnerable populations. I do want you to note in this figure that the gray is the lag period and data are still coming in. So I wish it was dropping like that, but we're not quite there yet. Let's go to the next slide. And I would like to just review how many hospitalizations have occurred in children in Minnesota. These are data as of November 2nd. And we have had over 1,000 children hospitalized. When we look at the whole course of the pandemic, that represents about 2.6% of total COVID hospitalizations, although it is a bit higher in recent months comparatively. And we have completed medical record review on almost 700 of these cases. Amongst those for which we've completed medical record review, 40% have had underlying conditions. And again, amongst those for which we've been able to complete a review, 27% were admitted to the ICU. 48% of those had comorbidities. Next slide, please. And here I'd like to show you hospitalizations in children, and you can see changes over time. And note that last year's fall wave, adolescents had higher rates of hospitalization, that's the red line, but these have dropped in the current fall wave. And note that hospitalizations are higher in the 0 to 4 age group, that is the blue line, and hospitalizations have increased in the 5 to 11 year age group compared with the fall peak in 2020. Let's go on to the next slide. And I do want to share some data from COVIDNet. COVIDNet is a surveillance system in collaboration with CDC that includes 14 states, of which we are one of them. And we do active population-based surveillance for hospitalized cases of COVID-19. Let's go to the next slide. And this system found that hospitalization increased comparing late June and August, which was the period, of course, when there was the rise of the Delta variant, with the period of March to mid-June. And I want to note that when we looked at the cases that were hospitalized in children, and this was also the case for adults, that there was not a significant increase in hospitalized patients with COVID who required ICU care or who died. So the proportion of severe disease among hospitalized was similar. However, the hospitalization rate was tenfold higher in that second time period in ages 0 to 4, and also tenfold higher among unvaccinated adolescents compared with vaccinated adolescents. Let's go to the next slide. So how long does immunity for COVID-19 last? Well, I wish I could give you a definitive answer. We are still learning. It is a brand new virus. There are new studies being reported on every day. Some things that have been a challenge in trying to determine it is that correlates of protection are not yet defined. And what I mean by that is if we look at a laboratory test, one test that we do think is important to assess the immunity is neutralizing antibody. But we don't know the precise level of neutralizing antibody that is associated with protection in an individual patient. We do have a sense of a group. So if we are doing studies, we can look at certain titers, but for an individual, we do not know this. And it is also more complicated because the antibody immunity is not the only thing involved in controlling SARS-CoV-2 infection and COVID. Protective immunity also includes cellular immunity. And then when we look at long-term immunity, we'd be looking at memory cells. So memory T cells, CD4 and CD8 cells, and memory B cells. We do think that immunity does last at least for a period of months, likely 6 months in most people. The protective immunity may protect against severe disease if someone is reinfected. It may not protect against getting reinfected. And another issue that is a challenge for us is the lack of standardization between assays that measure immunity. So these are tests that are not readily available in clinical laboratories, and the specific assays have differences that make it hard to compare. We also know that there are varying responses to this virus, and the duration of immunity may vary with age, disease severity, or immune compromise. We need to better understand the duration of immunity after infection, the duration of immunity after vaccination, or after infection plus vaccination. And we also need to understand the impact of mutational changes in the virus. So if there are new variants that have changes, say, for example, in the spike protein, how well will prior immunity from infection or from vaccination protect? Let's go to the next slide. I'm going to use a number of terms when I review studies. Fully vaccinated is 14 days after completion of a two-dose series for the messenger RNA vaccines, Pfizer and Moderna, or a single dose of the Janssen vaccine. Vaccine efficacy means how well a vaccine performs under ideal and controlled circumstances. Frequently, you will hear about vaccine effectiveness, and that is how well a vaccine performs under real-world conditions. And then we also will talk a little bit about vaccine breakthrough. And what that is how many cases have occurred among vaccinated persons. Next slide. So I'm going to show you the initial data from the clinical trials of the various vaccines. Pfizer found a 95% efficacy among persons 16 and older for symptomatic laboratory-confirmed COVID-19, and they had a very large group of participants in their trials. Trials were done in adolescents 12 to 15. It was a smaller group, and they used immunological bridging data. So they looked at antibody responses, a number of different types of antibody, and they had the data from the larger group of adults who were studied. So they had a comparison of what the antibody data would be. In that clinical trial, there were no cases of COVID-19 in the vaccine group. The trials that have just been reported amongst 5 to 11-year-olds, the vaccine efficacy was found to be 91%. They also had a smaller group and also used immunological bridging studies. Moderna
was found to have 94% efficacy among persons 18 years and older against symptomatic laboratory confirmed COVID-19. And again, they had a large trial. There are trials underway among adolescents, and the data are pending. Janssen was found to have a 66% efficacy amongst persons 18 years and older against symptomatic laboratory confirmed COVID-19. These were international studies, and the efficacy was actually found to be higher in the US at 74%. But importantly, the efficacy was 93% against hospitalization after 14 days. And there were no hospitalizations noted in the trial after 28 days in the vaccine group. And again, there were 40,000 participants. FDA requires a median time of 2 months for follow-up for the initial studies. And so in the midst of a pandemic, we want to get prevention measures out quickly. We don't have the time to follow people for a year or two to look at, do they wane over time? And hence, we are now learning about not only how the vaccine performs in the real world, but seeing, is there waning immunity? Is there a need for additional doses of vaccine? Let's go to the next slide. So I'm going to share a few studies. There are many, many studies, and every day more get published. But this will give you a gist of what we're seeing. So in this study, the vaccine effectiveness, so these are not clinical trials, this is looking at what is happening. There are observational studies. Here was a case control study where you compared PCR positive patients with PCR negative patients. This was done at 5 VA medical centers. And what they found was that the overall vaccine effectiveness was 87%. So not all that far off. For notably, though, they found that the vaccine effectiveness was significantly higher for 18 to 64 year olds at 95% versus 80% for those 65 or older. And they did see differences between Moderna and Pfizer. So in this study, they found Moderna was 92% effective at preventing hospitalization and 83% for Pfizer. And I want to just point out, I've given a lot of extra details on these slides. You can look at them. I've given the references. But, you know, depending on the population, you're going to see differences. There are some people who are at higher risk for hospitalization. There may be people who are at higher risk for exposure. So all these things need to be kept in mind. Let's go to the next slide. Here, the vaccine effectiveness was looked at in a large managed care group, and they used the electronic health record. And they looked at December through August 8th. There were more than 3.4 million persons in that data set, and they found, looking at Pfizer, the vaccine effectiveness was 73% against infection, 90% against hospital admission. However, they found that the effectiveness against infection decreased from 88% during the first month after full vaccination to 47% after 5 months, and that the effectiveness for those 65 and older overall during that period was 61%. However, when we look at severe disease, not just infection, the effectiveness was strong. It was 90% against hospital admission, and it did not significantly change when they looked out to 5 months. When they looked at vaccine effectiveness for age, it was 86% for those 65 and older and 92% for 18 to 44, although the confidence intervals just slightly overlap there. They found that vaccine effectiveness against hospitalization for the Delta variant was high and overlapped with other variants. Next slide, please. Another study looked at persons 18 years old who were not immunocompromised, who were admitted to 21 hospitals in the US. And here they again did a case control study with a test negative design. Their median age was 53. Their effectiveness against hospitalization was 93% for Moderna. And when they looked at the period before 120 days, so 14 days after the second vaccine, out to 120 days versus greater than 120 days, they found that there was a decline in Pfizer. It had been 91% and it declined to 77%. The vaccine effectiveness for Janssen against hospitalization was found to be 71%. Let's go to the next slide. Here was a study that looked at nursing home residents before and during the time when there was widespread circulation of Delta. And they found that two doses of the mRNA vaccines were 75% effective against infection early in the vaccination program. So March to May, you may recall that nursing home residents were a group that we all worked really hard to vaccinate early. However, during June to July, and this is the time that the Delta variant was circulating, effectiveness declined to 53%. Let's go to the next slide. ACIP, the Advisory Committee of Immunization Practices, has been having many, many meetings. And when they come up with recommendations, they publish them in the Morbidity and Mortality Weekly Report, also known as MMWR. This was just published a few days ago, and I thought it was useful because they reviewed additional studies. So just again, to give you a sense of what we're seeing. So in the context of waning vaccine-induced immunity and the predominance of Delta variant, declines in vaccine effectiveness of the mRNA vaccine has been observed for infection. I showed you one of the studies that they did include in their review, but they found that vaccine effectiveness was 75 to 84% among adults 65 and older, 53% among residents of long-term care facilities, and 66% among healthcare personnel. When they looked at effectiveness against hospitalization, the effectiveness remained high at 78 to 100%, depending on the study, although some studies showed slightly lower vaccine effectiveness in older adults for hospitalization. The Janssen has more limited data. And in fact, there was an article that was just published yesterday. Some studies suggest stable vaccine effectiveness over time. Amongst the studies they reviewed, the vaccine effectiveness of Janssen was 58 to 83% against infection and 60 to 83% against COVID-19 associated hospitalization among persons aged 18 and older. Next slide. So in response to these emerging data, CDC, as you know, did expand eligibility for COVID-19 booster shots. And because the vaccines, Moderna, Janssen, are still under EUA, Pfizer has been licensed for adults, but it was only licensed for a 2-dose series. So all these recommendations have to be reviewed by the FDA Vaccines and Related Biological Products Advisory Committee. FDA then authorizes it, the ACIP reviews it, and then Dr. Walensky then puts out the final recommendations. And so for persons who've received Pfizer or Moderna, the following groups are eligible for a booster shot at 6 months or more after their initial series. People who really should be getting a booster are those 65 years of age and older, those 18 to 64 who live in long-term settings, those 50 to 64 with underlying conditions. And others are eligible, including those 18 to 49 with underlying conditions, and 18 to 64 who work or live in high-risk settings. For persons who've received the Janssen one-dose vaccine, booster shots are recommended for all of those persons who were vaccinated 2 or more months prior. Next slide. ACIP also reviewed the data on immunocompromised, and I didn't show you those studies because of time, but the studies have found a decreased vaccine effectiveness in immunocompromised for mRNA vaccines, with a vaccine effectiveness of 71% versus 90% against infection one study, and 59% versus 91% against hospitalization. In a series of small studies, a number of solid organ transplant recipients and hemodialysis patients, and it's a wide range there because these were small studies, had no detectable antibody response after the second dose. However, 33 to 55% of them did develop antibodies after receiving an additional dose. And with these data, CDC did recommend a third dose for moderately to severe immunocompromised, and recommendations also exist for a booster dose for 6 months after the receipt of the third dose for certain immunocompromised individuals. Let's go to the next slide. So we have some early data from Israel. I do need to caution that some of the experience in Israel has been a bit different than our experience, but I think these data are useful in that they show that giving a booster not only gave people a boost in antibody, but in fact, they found in early studies when they were looking at, in this case, persons who were 6 years or older, at least 5 months had passed since their Pfizer vaccine, and they looked at 1 month after boosters, and they compared those who received the booster versus those who didn't, and the rates of confirmed infection at least 12 days after vaccination dropped by a factor of more than five, compared with those who did not receive the booster. And compared with getting the booster early on. So they're looking at the immune response at 12 days, but they also found a drop in infection when they compared those who had received the booster versus the non-booster, and this happened during their Delta surge. Let's go to the next slide. Another study from Israel that was just published took a look at a wider group. This was a health system with more than 1 million people. The median age was 52, because in Israel, they are issuing boosters much more broadly. And compared with persons who received two doses of the vaccine 5 months prior, persons who received three doses, and here they use a period of 7 days after the third dose, when they would not expect a boost or an immune response before. But they found that when they looked at 7 days or more after the booster, that there was a 93% lower risk of hospitalization and an 81% lower risk of death due to COVID. And there they found that it was similar across age groups and a number of comorbidities. Let's go to the next slide. So now I'm going to talk just a little bit about vaccine breakthrough. We've had a lot of questions about this. And this is work that we participated in with 12 other US jurisdictions. This came out in the beginning of September. And we found that after Delta became the common variant, fully vaccinated people had a reduced risk of an infection by 5 times, hospitalization and death by more than 10 times. Let's go to the next slide. And here are the data where you can see fully vaccinated are on that blue line and not fully vaccinated, the comparison group being the black line. Let's go to the next slide. And here are data that we are posting on our website. So this is the most recent data on vaccine breakthrough. And this initial table takes the number of fully vaccinated people age 12 and older and looks at the number of breakthrough cases in that group. And so when we do that, about 1.8% of fully vaccinated people have been identified as a case. The hospitalization rate amongst fully vaccinated people is 0.08% and deaths 0.01%. So although I'm showing you data about waning, I do want you to appreciate that the vaccines are providing good protection against hospitalization and death. Let's go to the next slide.
And Dr. Linfield, sorry to interrupt. So we only have about 15 minutes left and we do have another presentation. So I guess I just wonder if we can
speed it up.
Wrap it up a little more quickly. And I would like to give members a chance to ask questions if they have any.
Of course, you bet. So this is just similar data showing that if you're unvaccinated, you're at higher risk for infection, hospitalization, or death. Let's go to the next slide. And there are differences by age group. Let's go to the next slide. We do know that people who are vaccinated have less risk for being reinfected, at least as evidenced by emerging data. So this was one study that found that there was 2.3 times the odds of reinfection if you were unvaccinated and previously infected versus being fully vaccinated. Let's go to the next slide. And also, this was a recently published piece that found that those who had prior infection compared with those who were vaccinated, those who had prior infection had more than 5 times the risk of laboratory confirmed COVID-19 hospitalization. Let's go to the next slide. So CDC has come out with a science brief that they published Friday night. Let's go to the next slide. And it goes through comparison of immunity and people who have had natural infection versus vaccination. Let's go to the next slide. And the bottom line is that we don't know how well people who have had mild or asymptomatic disease are protected from reinfection, that there is variability in immunity. The immunity from vaccination is much more consistent and does produce an initial high level of antibody. And more data emerging that vaccination after infection enhances protection. And so CDC continues to recommend vaccination for all eligible persons, including those who've been previously infected. Next slide. Now, you've seen this definition from WHO. I won't go through it. Next slide. And you've heard about a bit where in the time course of the illness we start to see post-acute COVID. Let's go to the next slide. And I will end with some questions that we are looking at. Was the prevalence of long COVID symptoms in Minnesotans, adult children, by socio-demographic characteristics, the duration and severity of long COVID? How does long COVID impact activities of daily living? Has vaccination impact long COVID? What are the appropriate clinical screening and treatment protocols? How can we coordinate them both for adults and children? What are recommendations for individuals with comorbid conditions or disabilities? And what information and recommendations are needed by Minnesotans, healthcare providers, public health providers, community organizations, employers, schools, et cetera. Let's go to the last slide, which is what we are working on is to assess the burden of long COVID in Minnesota, in adults, children, rural, BIPOC communities. We are working on epidemiological studies, engaging with partners. We would like to put together some advisory groups. We want to develop some consensus clinical screening, evaluation, and treatment guidelines, as well as commonalities and follow-up and coordinated care recommendations for both primary care and specialists, and work on long COVID awareness and communications. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much, Dr. Linfield. There's a lot of information there. And, I think that the overriding message that I got from what you just presented is get vaccinated and get your booster.
Yes.
And and I think that you're showing that this is quite well supported. And I think it is a good moment to just make a comment here before we go to Assistant Commissioner Joanna Dornfeld, who's going to talk with us a little bit more, I think, about the vaccination of the children, which we just got on the slide. You know, I think it's really important for us to all remember that science does not move in a straight line, that when we're talking about science, we're never talking about knowing 100% of everything, right? We're always talking about what do we know today that we didn't know yesterday. And, you know, there's nothing ever perfect. You know, you can, you know, have a cancer and get a cancer treatment that is state of the art. And then 3 years later, there'll be some other treatment that is shown to be better in some cases. I'm just pulling that out of the air, you know, but this is just the way science works. But it doesn't mean that what we know isn't valid or that there's any, God forbid, conspiracy to keep people from knowing. It's just the way science works. And, it's quite, I have to say, quite impressive, the amount of work that's been done since we first learned about the this new, very new virus. So thank you so much for that presentation. So Assistant Commissioner Dornfeld, you're on.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair and members of the committee. It's a pleasure to be here with you today and to provide an update on the really exciting news that many of us, myself included, as a parent of two kids in this age bracket, who are now eligible to be vaccinated. So just a little bit of an update on kind of where MDH is and kind of what the decisions have been made over the last just week, really. But wanted to start kind of outlining the values that the Department of Health, working in close collaboration with our colleagues at the Department of Education and the Children's Cabinet, as well as the entire administration, our values for this age group. And our, you know, first goal, as it is for all Minnesotans, but is to really keep children healthy and safe and to minimize the number of children who become ill with COVID. Secondly, our vaccine strategy is really aimed at keeping kids learning in schools and learning in schools in person, which we know is so critically important. We are also looking to slow the spread of COVID in schools, families, and communities. I know you all have been watching the data like we have and seeing just the increased rate of COVID in our school children in our schools this year compared to last. And last year, you know, really working to ensure that we have vaccine access for all students and families all throughout the state. And so as we think about those goals and then drill down into what are those values and drill down to what our goals are, we're really aiming to vaccinate 5 to 11 year olds quickly, efficiently, and equitably. Our goal is that 80% of Minnesota children are vaccinated within 6 months of the emergency use authorization, and that 50% of those in this age group are vaccinated within the first 3 months of approval. And kind of for context for this group, there are nearly 510,000 Minnesota children that are in the ages between 5 and 11. We are also working to ensure that the vaccine is used quickly so that in these early weeks, particularly, that at least 90% of each week's allocation is used within kind of a week of its shipment. And then lastly, our goal that, again, provide equitable access and participation in vaccine across race, income, and geography. And one of some of the data points that we are using to kind of measure that are school district and county level data as well. Next slide, please. So the state role, the state really has kind of three primary roles when it comes to providing vaccine. Things you've seen at MDH and other and the administration doing kind of throughout our vaccine program here since early this year. The first is allocation and prioritization. We will be allocating the vaccine to align both with CDC guidance and to align with the administration goals to ensure the rapid vaccine administration equity and ensure we're meeting the greatest needs and that we are providing statewide coverage and access. And really filling in the gaps where our existing provider network is not able to offer vaccine. Secondly, the department and the administration, it's, you know, really important that we're providing kind of the leadership and collaboration to ensure that we are communicating, engaging with school and community leaders, providers, vaccine partner, community organizations to really coordinate and assess the needs so that we can best reach these kiddos. And then lastly, the state and MDH play an important role in terms of communication and education to make sure that we are reaching out to all communities to ensure that we're equitably providing the vaccine and we can address questions and make sure parents know where they need to go to get their child shot. Next slide, please. So in terms of the activities and actions just over the course of this last week, last week on the 26th, the Vaccine Advisory Committee that advises the FDA met on the 26th and recommended an emergency use authorization for the Pfizer vaccine for kids 5 to 11 years old. And on Friday, the FDA did issue that emergency use authorization, which was the point at which the CDC began shipments of vaccine to the state of to all states. So those shipments actually started on Monday. The CDC's advisory committee, ACIP, met on Tuesday. It's hard to believe just 2 days ago to make its guidance recommendations to the CDC about the administration of the vaccine. And Dr. Walensky made her final decision later in the evening on Tuesday, which allowed us to start offering vaccines to Minnesota children yesterday. We were able to pre-order and pre-position vaccine in the state of Minnesota, which is great. We started to receive our vaccine supply on Monday, and we anticipate that the first wave of ordering, which is over 170,000 doses, will be all in the state by Tuesday of next week. In addition, our federal pharmacy partners have been allocated more than 80,000 doses, and those we anticipate will be here before the weekend, this coming weekend. Next slide, please. So as we're thinking about kind of the various vaccinator locations and strategies to reach all of our kids across the state, we know that we need to have a diverse access. And so we'll be relying on kind of four primary strategies. The first is pharmacies. We know that a good segment of our 12 to 17 year old population did receive their COVID vaccines in pharmacies, and we anticipate they will be an important component of our vaccine strategy for the 5 to 11 year olds. In addition, the state of Minnesota has more than 500 vaccines for children providers across the state who have registered to also administer the COVID vaccine, including our federally qualified healthcare centers. And they are, again, also will be an important place, particularly for children with higher needs and an important place for parents to go to be able to ask questions if they have questions about the vaccine. We also know that schools are an incredibly important access point for parents and families. I know my kids have had the opportunity to get their flu vaccine at their school events as long as they've been, you know, in schools. And so we'll be partnering with schools, and the first clinics actually are today to administer vaccines in schools and provide that very easy access for parents and families. And then lastly, we'll be continuing to leverage our community-based vaccination sites, both smaller sites in partnership with our COVID community coordinators. And also we have expanded the Mall of America community vaccination site to be able to provide more than 1500 shots each day. Next slide, please. And as I mentioned, one of the key resources or, you know, roles of the state of Minnesota is really providing that important information to answer questions for parents and families and to make sure they know where to go to get vaccinated. And so yesterday we launched mn.gov/vax4kids, which is a one-stop place to answer parents' questions and to also provide information specifically about those vaccine locations all across the state. I can pause there and happy to answer any questions. I know we're running short on time, but thank you for the opportunity.
Yeah, thank you so much. And I'm going to call on Representative Munson in a second, but I just, if you said this, Assistant Commissioner, I think it does bear emphasis, right, that children will not be vaccinated without their parents' permission, correct? At school or anywhere?
That is without, correct.
Right, or their guardian, of course, right?
Yes, thank you, Chair Liebling. Yes, it is absolutely required for parents to provide parental consent
okay.
for their children to be vaccinated.
Very good. And I've been told that we can run over by a few minutes, and I do want to allow some questions here. And I don't know if some of those might be for Dr. Linfield, so I hope she's still here. So Representative Munson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And this would be for Assistant Commissioner Dornfield, and really does have to do with parental consent, as the chair just spoke about. Really some clarifying information from you, hopefully. It's my understanding it's against the law to vaccinate a child without parental consent. So the Education Commissioner, Heather Mueller, made a statement saying that that if the child's school offers an on-site clinic like you're partnering with, that it would be up to the school district or vaccine provider whether a parent must be present. The governor has been offering $200 to kids to get vaccinated, meet and greets with sports celebrities. And I'm concerned that just a permission slip with a parent's signature showing up at school may be enough for a school to decide it's okay to vaccinate a child when we know that kids sign, you know, permission slips and such all the time. So my concern is I really want the parents to be present at the school if the kid's going to get a vaccination. And is it your department's policy that just a signed permission slip by a parent would suffice for kids to be vaccinated? Because as you know, there's many children who have had adverse reactions. And so another sibling, it's a very medical and personal decision. So is the department going to push for parents to be present, or do you think that a signed permission slip is enough?
Ms. Dornfeld?
Thank you, Chair Liebling and Representative, for the question. It's a very important one and something that the Department of Health takes very seriously. It is ultimately up to an individual provider to determine what they require to administer a vaccine. However, the providers that the Minnesota Department of Health has contracted with to be our vaccinator partners. They require parental presence to administer the vaccine for anyone under the age of 16.
And before we move on as well, there was something embedded in the question about something like, as you know, children have gotten a lot of reactions or a lot of adverse reactions. I wonder if Dr. Linfield could just speak to that before we move on, because I think that's extremely important that we clarify that. And maybe some of the succeeding questions will be about that. I don't know. But Dr. Linfield, can you address that point?
Yes, sure. Thank you, Madam Chair. So just to remind folks that the dose for vaccine for those 5 to 11 is 1/3 of the adult dose, so it's a much smaller dose. And in the trial, the vaccine reactions were comparable or less for the most part. It was found to be very safe, particularly when they compared to older people tended to have a bit more of the systemic reactions.
Okay, thank you. Representative Pryor and then Schultz, and then I think we're gonna probably have to shut it down here. Representative Pryor.
All right, I'll try to be quick. So I a huge debt of gratitude to the Department of Health, especially since those vaccinations are available now. And I know when I got my vaccination, the first one, it was such an emotional day to feel like finally there was light, there was something that I could do other than, you know, stay home and not be with people. And now today, one of my grandchildren that's in that age group is going to get her vaccination and she's going to be over for dinner. We're going to celebrate. And so I know that, again, this is a whole new phase of this, of the pandemic. But it's such a great step forward. And I know that there's a lot of hard work that went into making sure that these are available right now. So I want to thank you and congratulate all the people and thank all the people that made this possible. And then also the point that I sent that link to the website for, could you just repeat that again? So anybody watching this, that would be the take home message. Go to that link, follow up on it, and find out where you can get your kids vaccinated.
Thank you. Let's see, who can read the slide? Ms. Dornfeld?
Absolutely, thank you for the question. It's mn.gov/vaxforkids.
Vax for kids. Thank you. Okay. Representative Schultz.
Thank you, Chair Liebling. I just have a question for Assistant Commissioner Dornfeld. I'm getting questions in my community about the on-site vaccination clinics at schools, and we're wondering if there's transportation available for the parents, and if that seems could be a barrier, and we're wondering if MDH is addressing that concern.
Ms. Dornfeld.
Thank you, Chair Liebling and Representative Schultz. I would be happy to connect with you offline to learn more about the concerns that are being raised. We have provided through the course of the pandemic, and particularly in partnership with our COVID community coordinators, access to transportation resources for clinics. And I can connect with our community vax team as well, who's been working directly with the superintendent to understand what barriers might be present and if there's ways that we can assist.
Okay, well, thank you so much. And I do see Representative Quam's hand, but we are over time. And so we'll have to take that one offline. And so thank you again to all of our presenters. And thanks for everybody for taking time out of your interim to be here. And we stand adjourned.